Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. It's not often on Brussels Sprouts that we get turkey because it's CNES and have a ground in one of those issues that has fallen through our cracks. But there is just so much that is going on from Turkey in the Eastern Mediterranean, the flare-up of the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. We could go on and on. So we felt like we needed to hit this issue head-on and that we needed to bring in a true expert to help us out to do that. So that's what we've done today. We're sitting down with Soner Çaptay. Soner is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's written extensively on Turkish politics, U.S.-Turkey relations, and he's the author of a book, Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East.
And I like to take this time to do a shout out for Rob Satloff, who runs the Institute and is a good friend. And it was at his house where I met Soner for the first time. And I knew we were destined to do something together because when I was the DASD for Europe and NATO, I would say I spent half my time working on issues dealing with Turkey. And they weren't all problems. There were also a lot of very good things that we did together. But after the coup attempt, things turned a little crazy. So it's great to kind of to circle back and find out what's been going on since I left the Pentagon.
Awesome. Well, welcome, Soner.
Thank you, guys. It's a great pleasure. I'm delighted to be on Brussels Sprouts with you and look forward to a great conversation on Turkey. I agree with you that it's a country that's important for us to discuss and analyze and parse out. So very excited to be part of this conversation with you.
Well, maybe we can start with like a very big picture question. And I think kind of undoubtedly, I would say that Turkey must be one of the United States' most difficult relationships. It's a NATO ally, but it's purchased Russian defense equipment, provoked tensions with Greece. In Syria, it's targeted U.S. partner forces. It's led by a president who's undermined democracy and rule of law. So it's obviously a complex, complicated relationship. And maybe just it would be awesome to hear from you kind of how you think about the U.S.-Turkey relationship. How would you characterize it currently?
You hit the nail right on the head. First things first, I would say one of the reasons I love to study Turkey, and I've been a student of Turkey for over two decades, is I believe that if countries could be vegetables, Turkey would be the analytical onion. It's a country that never has a core. It defies Manichaean binarisms and broad generalizations. So you really have to kind of go under the skin of the country, to use another analogy, to get into what Turkey is. Yes, Turkey is complicated. It's because Turkey has multiple identities. It's rooted in Europe, but it also has a Middle Eastern neighborhood. It borders Russia across the Black Sea. It's a U.S. ally, or has been since entering NATO in 1952. And yes, domestic politics-wise also, it is a country, once again, that defies these broad generalizations. And is Turkey's president autocratic? Yes, he is. Is Turkey a democracy? Yes, it is. So Turkey, therefore, is one of these hybrid regimes where it's a democracy run by an autocrat. It's a U.S. ally that's dealing with adversaries of the United States. And I think maybe Turkey is kind of getting ready, or is already getting ready for what it sees as the arrival of the post-American world. It's basically saying, I can't rely on my ally United States to always watch for my back. I'm going to try to take care of my own security concerns. So we have therefore seen a more muscular Turkish foreign policy in the last few years. And as Jim pointed out, that's quite surprising because only 4 years ago, there was a failed coup attempt against Erdogan, a nefarious plot, nefarious because it was part of the military attacking the rest of the military and Erdogan. The country recovered from this coup attempt pretty fast, and its military has made an impressive comeback. They're fighting wars right now on four fronts. In Iraq, using drones against PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is a list on U.S. State Department's Foreign Terrorist Organizations list, which is a group on the FTO Foreign Terrorist Organizations list. They're fighting a war by supporting Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh, trying to help Azeris take back occupied territory from the Armenians. And they're fighting a war, again, using drones in Libya, in that country's civil war. So four fronts four wars with direct or proxy involvement, and a very difficult to grasp domestic landscape where you got an autocratic leader, but a very resilient democratic political culture. That's why I think we have so much to discuss on Turkey today.
You know, that was an absolutely brilliant tour de table, as we say, NATO, about Turkey. And I just wanted to add from an American perspective and from someone who's worked with Turkey for many decades, there's an intense friendship there too. It's a new friendship. We don't have as long a relationship with Turkey as we have with other European countries. Like you said, it was birthed with NATO primarily. But I have found in dealing with Turkey that the friendships that I've developed there and the collegiality is very intense. And when I go to Turkey, I remember so many times in the past while I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary going to Ankara for meetings. And when I would go out into the restaurants, as soon as they saw, and because I guess I stand out as an American, as soon as they saw me, I was always so well taken care of and given the best seat and the best food and the best attention. And I remember leaving a restaurant and just to everyone applauding each other because we just felt that close in terms of this friendship there. And as Turkey has gone up and down with military dictatorships and then, of course, the Erdogan issues and things like that, I've always felt that there was this core or this base of friendship that you can't take for granted, but was there. And it's hard to explain why, because we're very different countries and different peoples, but it's real and it's there. And it's something that I feel has got to be protected. And so it can be frustrating. I think both of you laid out how difficult it can be, but at the end of the day, it is worth it. It is worth it because of this friendship that is there. I don't know how it is out of Ankara, and I've been to Istanbul certainly, but I don't know how the Turks might feel out in the rural areas, if you will. But I have always found this intensity in that relationship and in that friendship that I hope that in the years to come we protect, no matter the political winds.
It is true, Jim, that Turks have long favored the United States and have warm feeling towards Americans. And this is something you know if you travel to Turkey. By the way, if anybody's listening to our podcast and they haven't been there, I recommend that they go and visit a country with lots of amazing culture and cities and really amazing food. That's a big bonus, of course.
Yes.
But let's take a more dispassionate view of Turkish-U.S. relationship. So for America, I think allies multiply America's influence overseas. You know, Japan, Korea, Colombia, Turkey, Germany, these countries, alliance with these countries inside NATO and other platforms is not something where the United States wastes money, in my view. It's rather that investing in these countries' security and doing stuff with them allows the U.S. to multiply its influence overseas. Turkey has multiplied U.S. influence in its region for a number of decades now. And for Turkey, the United States does something similar. Turkey is a mid-sized power. It's not a small country. It's a pretty sizable economy. It's the biggest economy between Germany and India. It has the second largest military inside NATO. It, in fact, has a pretty darn good military, as we have seen in the campaigns they are fighting. They pushed back against forces of General Haftar in Libya's civil war. When Putin allowed Turkey a freedom of action last year, Turkey pummeled Assad regime forces, nearly destroyed their military in an extremely well-executed drone campaign in less than a week. So a pretty effective military, large economy, and a population, that's really the important part of it. Despite the efforts of President Erdogan to change Turkey's direction from away from Europe, a population that still looks up to Europe as the model to be emulated, to be followed. Turkey's citizens, including followers of President Erdogan, do not want to be emulate or look up to China, Iran, or Russia. They look up to European Union countries and the West. So I would say, taking all these into account, for Turkey, a middle-sized country with these this vocation, I think Turkey has seen its relationship with the U.S. as one that has helped guard its security interests. But having said this, I think I should add that U.S.-Turkish relationship has run into troubles, and they are linked to wars in two of Turkey's neighbors, Iraq and Syria, and that have led to serious divergences, which I think we should also discuss and debate.
I want to definitely tick through the different conflicts that you mentioned, and we'll do that in a second, but it brings up such an interesting point, the kind of the differences between the public, the Turkish people, and Erdogan. And it seems to me that over, particularly in the last 4 years, there has been such a personalization of the U.S.-Turkey relationship. It almost reminds me of the U.S.-Russia relationship, where there's become just a sole focus on the leader at the top. We equate Russia with Putin, and increasingly it feels like people in the United States and certainly among policymakers are now equating Turkey with Erdogan. And that seems like such a mistake. And I wonder, you know, if you're thinking about how do you depersonalize the relationship? How should we think about kind of moving away from that narrow focus and adjusting policies to make it bigger than Erdogan?
I agree, Andrea. Remember I started saying countries would be vegetables, Turkey would be the analytical onion. Here's the case. A lot of people look at Russia and Putin and say, Turkey is like Russia and Erdogan is like Putin. I say, hey, that's a really broad generalization. Erdogan likes Putin. I think he has a political man crush on Putin. He loves the way Putin governs. They're both autocratic leaders.
Maybe like friend, our current president as well.
A friend called me after the Istanbul elections last year when Erdogan's party lost and said, I heard Putin called to congratulate Erdogan. What do you think he said to Erdogan? I told my friend, I said, I don't think Putin called to congratulate Erdogan. I think Putin called him to say, how do you lose elections? So that's the Erdogan-Putin political romance. But Turkey and Russia are very different when it comes to their democratic traditions and legacies. Turkey has been a multi-party democracy holding free and fair elections since 1950. That means longer than has been Spain. It has deep democratic traditions, which means it has democratic resilience and vigilance. What does that mean? Last year, President Erdogan's party lost elections for Istanbul, primarily because the economy slowed down after delivering quite phenomenal economic growth in the context of Turkish history, lifting many people out of poverty and building himself a base of adoring supporters who worship him. Erdogan faced troubles because economies in Turkey entered into recession in 2018, so he lost the Istanbul vote. By a narrow margin, Istanbul is a city of 15 million people, a margin of 13,000 votes. So Erdogan said, I control institutions, I have media on my side, I have electoral bodies, electoral boards. Let me repeat these elections and I'll win it. And you know what happened? Democratic resilience pushed back. In the second round, his candidate lost the vote by nearly a million votes, 800,000 to be precise. That's what resilience is. If you live in a country where you voted, your parents voted, your grandparents voted, you know what it means to be voted. Your vote can't be rigged. So elections are not fair in Turkey, but they are free. And I think he was humbled by that. So I would say, if you want to compare Turkey to other countries, compare it to Hungary and Poland, where similarly autocratic leaders, Orban and Kaczynski's allies, have taken power in Budapest and Warsaw, respectively. But just as it happened in Turkey, in Budapest and Warsaw, those countries' autocratic leaders recently lost mayoral races to the opposition. So I think Turkey looks more like East European, Central European countries such as Hungary and Poland, if we want to use an adjective to describe its democracy, then it does like Russia.
I want to stay on the Russia thing just for 1 second, and then we can move. I want to get to the Mediterranean and other things. But the interesting thing about the Russia-Turkey relationship is that they've managed to maintain a decent relationship despite the fact that they're on opposite sides of the conflict now in Syria, in Libya, and now we can add Nagorno-Karabakh kind of to
perhaps,
that
yeah.
as well. So can you describe a little bit about that bilateral relationship and how they are able to kind of thread that needle, maintaining the strong relationship?
Absolutely. And I think the evolution of Turkish-Russian ties in the last few years speaks in volumes about why we should not reduce Turkey down to its leader or our passions for its leader, negative or positive. So Turkish-Russian ties are historically hostile. Russia is Turkey's nemesis. By my count, as I've written in my book, Erdogan's Empire, the Ottomans and the Russians fought 17 wars between the time they became neighbors and until the collapse of the Russian Empire with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. Guess who started all these 17 wars overall? The Russians. Guess who lost them overall? The Turks. So not only is it a Russian nemesis, but it's also a militarily superior power. Erdogan's involvement in Syria's uprising, in my view, was short-sighted, because without securing firm U.S. support, and President Obama was never going to put boots on the ground in a Muslim-majority country, Erdogan thought that he could push Assad out, a dictator of Damascus, but he forgot that Assad is supported by the Russians. So his involvement in Syria put Turkey and Russia on a collision course where it looked like the 18th war was going to start, and you don't need to have a crystal ball to figure out who's going to win. But then things changed. Russians deployed troops to Syria, and then it looked like there was going to be a new conflict. Turkey shut down a Russian plane that violated its airspace from Syria in November 2015. Putin slapped really harsh sanctions. It looked like the 18th war was going to start. A dramatic set of events, and in July 2016, completely changed Putin's behavior towards Turkey. Coup attempt against Erdogan. It was a nefarious plot, as I said earlier. It was a faction within the military that attacked the rest of the military and the government. The country's capital was bombed. Erdogan barely escaped for his life. Guess how long it took Turkey's allies, including NATO members, to reach out to Erdogan? Days and sometimes weeks. Guess how long it took Putin to reach out to Erdogan? He called Erdogan the day after the coup. He offered him protection. He basically gave him his best wishes and invited him to Russia. Erdogan made his first visit overseas after the coup, not to Brussels, the capital of NATO alliance, of which Turkey is a member, which is where he should have gone. It should have been invited by NATO leaders, but to Russia. And more symbolically, Putin did not invite him to Moscow, the Russian capital. He invited him to St. Petersburg, Russia's imperial capital, hosting him at the Konstantinovsky Palace, built by Catherine the Great. So his message was, my predecessor, Catherine the Great, started the tradition of bullying your nation. I, Putin the Great, will end it. Let's have a deal. And he said, you can now go into Syria if you want to undermine this Kurdish group called People's Protection Forces, which is an offshoot of another Kurdish group, Kurdistan Workers Party. That's a group on State Department's foreign terrorist organizations list. Putin said, by all means, you can go in and hurt this group that your quotes, in quotes, of course, for Putin, American allies are working with to defeat ISIS. So that policy where Turkey had grudgingly accepted that the U.S. worked with its sworn enemy to defeat ISIS is something Putin took advantage of after the failed coup. Number one, he allowed Turkey to go into Syria. But, you know, I think Putin is so smart. He achieved so much while doing so little. So he used this post-coup opening that Turkey's Western allies and friends missed. He did not commit what I call reductio ad Erdoganum. He did not reduce Turkey down to Erdogan. He basically said, it's a bigger country than that. And it really is. As I explained, it remains democratic. The country's population hasn't folded under him, despite Erdogan's heavy-handed tactics. But Putin's goal was to use Syria to wedge U.S. and Turkey against each other. And it worked. So the biggest issue in a Turkish relationship right now is Turkey's decision after the coup to purchase Russian-made S-400 missile defense system. Congress has legislated sanctions. Thankfully, the President Trump, hasn't implemented those sanctions fully yet, because they would, if they were fully implemented, completely rupture the U.S.-Turkish relationship. Sometimes I think we believe that the Cold War is over. It is over. But I wonder if Putin thinks the first half of the Cold War that ended in 1991 is over, and that Russia is now winning to fight its second half, and it's playing really well. And how do you win the second half? You pit NATO's second largest military, Turkey, against its biggest military, United States. And what kind of divisive issues you have? S-400. If you asked me, you said, Soner, when do you think Putin first dangled the offer to sell Putin S-400 missile defense system? I would say at the Konstantinovsky Palace, because Putin's platitudes don't come for free. He offered Erdogan protection. I think Erdogan relies on Putin and will continue to rely on him, because for him, Putin is the protector of threatened leaders globally. If a leader is challenged, whether he's Maduro, Assad, maybe Lukashenko, that leader stays in power if Putin supports him. But also Putin has, of course, allowed Turkey freedom of action in Syria. The two countries are now what I call soft power sharing in Syria. They're not allies, they're soft power sharing. Putin wants to replicate this model in Libya, and as you said, Andrea, maybe Nagorno-Karabakh, but his bigger game there is not sharing Libya and Syria with the Turks. it is dealing with Turkey, peeling it away from the United States. And I think he's done a quite masterful job. I would say he's one of the smartest global players around.
Oh my gosh, you just put so much meat on the table. I don't even know what thread to pull on. But maybe we could start with the S-400 issue.
Let's do that.
And kind of, I guess the question is, if you were sitting in the White House and you had a decision about whether to move forward and implement the Qatsa sanctions or not, what would you do? And the S-400 isn't operational. So is there some way to work this, that if Turkey agrees to not make the system operational, that we avoid implementing sanctions on a treaty ally? Or how would you navigate the situation?
So Turkey's decision, or Erdogan's decision rather, after the coup attempt against him, when Putin reached out to him to purchase this missile defense system, has already hurt U.S.-Turkish military relationship. Turkey has been kicked out of F-35 project, which is NATO's next generation of fighter planes. They're the best, and Turkey won't be part of that. These projects are generational. They take decades. So that means Turkey is now cut out of defense cooperation with the U.S. for maybe 2-3 decades if we don't see a reversal of course. The president has not implemented a badge of sanctions called Qatsa sanctions that would not only completely debilitate U.S.-Turkish military relationship, but could also undermine Turkey's economy and its leadership. So the question is, how do you thread the needle? Obviously, there are a lot of people who are angry at Erdogan on the Hill, where these sanctions have been legislated, and some of them are rightfully angry at him. I think his democratic transgressions cannot be forgiven. I would say, Andrea, Turkey has never been this unfree under a democratically elected government. Yes, it is a democracy, but its leader is so autocratic that increasingly it's becoming what I would call a hybrid regime that's more away from being a democracy. I am hopeful in the long term and maybe short term that the opposition is going to make a comeback, especially because the loss in Istanbul and Ankara last year's elections empowered the opposition, and now they seem to be offering better models of governance than Erdogan's party is. But let's leave that aside. Let's come back to U.S.-Turkish relationship. I think that the only way you can walk back is the following. Putin will not accept a return merchandise offer because he wants to sell the system to Turkey, not because he's making $2.5 billion, which is a pretty sizable amount of change, but primarily because if the sales goes through, meaning if Turkey turns the system on, then it becomes sanctionable and U.S.-Turkish relationship will collapse, and Putin will have reached his ultimate goal of rupturing NATO's two largest militaries away from each other. So I think the only way we can thread the needle is Turkey keeps the system but doesn't turn it on. And Turkey can come up with multiple excuses for this, technical, political. Putin won't be happy with them necessarily. It would require some backroom diplomacy that we don't hear about necessarily. It would require the U.S. to tolerate that kind of a modus vivendi where Turkey keeps it but doesn't turn it on or doesn't plug it in. I think if there's a will, there's a way. That's why you have great diplomats, people who can find solutions that we can't necessarily put into fine print here. But I would believe that solutions are possible if you got leaderships on both sides that want to get there.
Wow. Well, I agree with you. I had suggested that they keep them in a warehouse, the S-400, and
you're very smart, Jim.
Yeah, just keep it there and with us, call it a day. But let me take you into another part of this strange Turkish, well, not strange, but this interesting Turkish-Russian relationship. And let's look at Cyprus. What's interesting, you know, we've talked about Libya, we talked about Syria, Nagorno-Karabakh, but there's also problems with Greece and Turkey that are historic, and we know about those, as well as the Cypriot problems that are ongoing too. But what's interesting to me right now is, of course, Cyprus and Russia are very close. There's a lot of Russian investment and tourism and ownership of banks in Cyprus. And so we see now Turkey fishing in troubled waters there vis-a-vis Russia, in the sense that, as you know, the Turkish company wants to do the gas drilling near Cyprus. Also in the disputed islands in the Aegean that the Greeks are all concerned about. We almost had a clash a few weeks ago. Another example of Greece another example of Turkey and fishing in waters that are important to Russia. Russia is very concerned about where Cyprus is going to go, and the Cypriot Russian relationship. So why is Turkey, I understand that they've reintroduced that the drilling ship again, I guess it was yesterday I read, that they're back out into the disputed waters. Why is Turkey pushing that so hard right now?
So here's the strategic environment in the Eastern Med as Turkey sees it. Largely as a result of Erdogan's policies, Turkey has no friends in the Eastern Med. You know, its old adversaries have become more adversarial, that's Greece and Cyprus. It has lost some good friends, Israel, and its ties with some other countries, Egypt, have come undone because of Erdogan's support to the Muslim Brotherhood that came to power in Egypt during Arab uprisings and was ousted from power by General Sisi. Erdogan never recognized Egypt's current president as legitimate and has threatened to take him to the UN and international courts. He ruptured Turkey's ties with Israel. And despite his initial efforts to unify Cyprus in 2004, a plan that failed because Greek Cypriots rejected it, not Turkish Cypriots or Turkey, Erdogan has now also become more nationalist against Greeks and Cypriots. Why? So as Turkey sees it, these four countries, old adversaries, Greece and Cyprus, and new adversaries, Egypt and to a lesser extent Israel, are coming together daily almost, setting up all new initiatives, always excluding Turkey, whether these are natural gas related or security related. So as Ankara sees it, Turkey is being boxed in the East Mediterranean by old and new adversaries, by an axis stretching from Athens to Tel Aviv. So Turkey's policy, pushback against who? The weakest link in this quartet, and that's Cyprus, followed by Greece. So that's why I think you've seen kind of Turkey push back, and Greece has done its own pushback. So there are many issues in the Eastern Med and the Aegean related to power sharing in Cyprus, the limitation of territorial waters and airspace, and those were until recently technical disputes. But now I think that East Med has become a polyhedron where these issues are now being conflated or muddled by debates over concerns over migration, regional rivalries, and security. Libya next door, a civil war where Turkey is fighting the internationally backed government in Tripoli. Greece, which is upset by Turkey's push in Eastern Med, is supporting General Haftar's forces that are fighting in the east of the country against Turkish-backed forces in the west in Tripoli. So now you're seeing how Libyan civil war and conflict in Eastern Med are enmeshed together. They're no more separate things. And disputes in the Eastern Med between Turks and Greeks are no more about who owns which island and which airspace. It's more about national rivalries. I wonder if this is linked to the arrival of post-American age, where countries in the region are saying, I'm not going to abide by rules anymore. I'm just going to try to carve out what is best for me. So as a result, I think Turks are basically pushing back against Greeks. Greeks are pushing against Turks. That's unfortunate. The good news is NATO has stepped in, NATO Secretary General, and I think NATO can be the neutral arbiter here. Both countries are members of NATO. EU has stepped in. I don't think EU can play a good role because Greece and Cyprus are EU members, Turkey's not. So it's unrealistic to expect EU to be a neutral arbiter. But NATO has played a good role. Tensions have come down. I'm a huge supporter of continued Turkish-Greek dialogue to resolve their problems. But I'm also a realist. I know that all these disputes between Turkey and Greece will be resolved when Turkey enters the EU, which will be under the Kosovo presidency. Kind of a nerdy joke. Everybody got it.
No, that's good. I like that. Well, you know, one of the countries to throw on the heap that you were just talking about involved in the Eastern Med is France. Suddenly, the French decided to step in and play not just an active role, but a military one. And France, of course, is also involved with Libya. They've been in Lebanon now, as you know, in Beirut. And so it's a very interesting French play. How is that going over in the Eastern Med?
Absolutely. If you ask me, you said, Soler, what is the next flashpoint inside NATO? You were so worried about U.S.-Turkish tensions. I would say not U.S.-Turkish ties. We're not going to have a flashpoint. But if we were to have one in NATO, it'd be Franco-Turkish ties. The two countries are at loggerheads in Libya. They support opposing side through arming proxies in a civil war. That's the closest two NATO allies have come to the brink of war in recent memory. Turkey supports the internationally recognized government in Tripoli. France supports the force of General Haftar. Number one, it's all about money. You know, everybody talks about lofty principles. France has long kind of seen North Africa as its sphere of influence. Libya is Africa's richest country by per capita income. It's got a small population, lots of oil and natural gas wealth. And everybody wants to benefit from Libya's reconstruction. The country went through two civil wars. There's going to be lucrative deals and contracts. The French and Turks are both vying for these contracts. It's all about money. So I think that has put them at loggerheads. But at the same time, France has decided to side with Greece and Cyprus in the East Med conflict. So you see how these conflicts are coming together. And so France has promised military support to Greece and Cyprus to push back against Turkey. And there's a third element of this rivalry. I think it's also political. You know, Ataturk's Turkey, which basically is the 20th century country, was a model of secularist politics. Not secular, but secularist, which meant no religion in government or politics. Erdogan has, for the most part, eliminated that model. For the most part, because there's a pushback against it, which I'm happy to talk about, among millennials. But whereas Ataturk's Turkey was the epitome of French model of laïcité, it's a French word, it means no religion in education and politics. Erdogan's model of political Islam is the antidote to the French model of laïcité. So I think for the French, this is also saying, we don't want to see political Islam in Libya and Maghreb and North Africa, which the French consider their sphere of influence. So you have that element too. And then you have two presidents, Macron and Erdogan, who looks like they want to make the other side their punching bag in their re-election campaign. So unfortunately, I'm worried about the course of French-Turkish ties. I think that Turkey might become the punching bag of Macron's election campaign in 2021, and Macron might become the punching bag of Erdogan's re-election campaign. The good news is I don't think Turkey and France will fight NATO allies, just as I don't think Turkey and Greece will fight. I think these tensions will escalate. Of course, you're always worried about accidental run-in dogfights that has happened in the past. Turks and Greeks have accidentally shot each other's planes when these planes were engaged in dogfights over the Aegean. So barring these accidental incidents, I do not expect conflict to become a military one. So that's good news. The bad news, of course, all this undermines NATO unity. And who does it serve again? Vladimir Putin. He's the big winner, which is why I think he's kind of tried to position himself as a firefighter in Libya, trying to broker peace so he can turn this into another Syria, meaning another area where he and the Turks kind of power share, and that benefits Putin's broader goal of spreading influence and also wedging Turkey and the United States against each other.
One other thing I wanted to ask about is if the United States is going to keep a special operations force in Syria working with the YPG to counter ISIS, which, you know, some indications about what Biden might do in a next presidency suggest that could be the case. How will that affect the future of U.S.-Turkey relations under a Biden administration, for example? How will they be able to navigate that, which has been such a sore point in the...
Absolutely, Andrea. The good news is the YPG issue is no more the sore point in U.S.-Turkish relationship. It was for a long time. So here's how it went. The United States wanted to fight ISIS in Syria. President Obama did not want to put boots on the ground. The YPG said, I will help you. Now, the problem, of course, is that the YPG is an offshoot of another Kurdish group called Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK. That's a terror-designated entity by all NATO members. So United States worked with an offshoot of a terrorist group to fight another terrorist group. That wasn't too welcome in Turkey. People said that the PKK is a sworn enemy and its offshoot, therefore, represents a threat to the United States. But Turkey kind of looked the other way. Because it said, fine, so long as it helps you defeat ISIS. For Turkey, the problem was the relationship remained between Turkey and YPG after the defeat of ISIS. And then the issue was to what extent the Turks would be comfortable with U.S. working with YPG across the border in Syria. That was the sore point in the relationship. Turkish incursion into northeastern Syria pushed the YPG away from the Turkish border. Syria's border with Turkey is no more controlled by the YPG. So that's no more a sore point in the U.S.-Turkish relationship, but Turkey hasn't won either. Guess who controls the border now? It's Assad regime and Russia. So Turkey's two adversaries. It's not as if Turkey wins from this in the long term. It's also a net loser. So I think at this stage, neither side has clearly come out of this with a solution to their liking. But I would also say the YPG issue is no more the sore point in the relationship because it's nowhere on Turkey's border with Syria.
There's a lot of folks on the Hill who are, you know, angry with Erdogan, democracy and human rights issues, the purchase of the S-400, and there's a lot of voices advocating a much harder line on Turkey. But there's some potential risks and potential backlash, you know, which include possibly pushing Turkey closer to Russia, or perhaps there's some other unintended consequences. So how do you think about what the right kind of tone and tenor of a U.S.-Turkey relationship should be moving forward?
So one school says, you know, criticize Turkey, sanction it, criticize and target Erdogan. Is shaming and blaming Turkey a policy that makes you feel good? Yes, it is. Is it the right policy for the United States? I don't think so. Here's why. Erdogan is among the inventors of nativist populist politics globally in the 21st century. Yes, he's delivered phenomenal economic growth, which is why his base loves him. But he's also a nativist populist leader who demonizes, brutalizes, and cracks down on demographics unlikely to vote for him. And he also says that he's going to make Turkey great. Again, I'm not making this up. And he says if he's under attack, it's because people don't want Turkey to become a great nation, that anyone who wants Turkey to be a great nation should support him. So he takes any criticism of Turkey to say this is an attack on me personally because these outside adversaries do not want Muslims and Turks to rise under my leadership. So I think when you are targeting Turkey directly, Erdogan will use that to boost his base. So we need to have a smart, intelligent policy. Perhaps, take into account that, yes, Erdogan commanded a very strong support base inside Turkey, but that's no more the case. Erdogan relied on a plurality to govern Turkey. Because of two economic recessions in 2018 and this year in 2020, his now support is dropped. Position that's making a comeback. I think the United States policy regarding Turkey should take into account that regardless of your passions for Erdogan, Turkey is a very important country for the U.S. Here's why. The Turkey borders Iran, Iraq, Syria, Russia across the Black Sea, and formerly ISIS-held territories in the Middle East. Whatever U.S. policies are regarding those five countries and entity, they're much easier with Turkey on board. They're much more cumbersome without Turkey on board, much more costly. How long does it take you to fly a drone from Incirlik base in southern Turkey to strike an ISIS target inside Syria? 20 minutes. How long does it take you to fly a drone from the Persian Gulf, where the U.S. has military bases, to strike the same ISIS target in Syria? For hours, you do the math. Basically, with Turkey on board, U.S. military and U.S. policies are more easily implementable, less costly. These policies can be implemented without Turkey on board as well. There's no doubt they'll be more costly. They're still doable, but Turkey can be a facilitator or a spoiler of U.S. policy. And the issue is, on whose side will Turkey be? On America's side? On Iran's side? On Russia's side? I don't think we're getting the old Turkey back. The old Turkey of the 20th century that was a staunch U.S. ally. Yes, Turks still look up to Europe as their yardstick of what their country ought to be. But I think as a result of changes implemented by Erdogan, some of Turkey's do not necessarily see their country as being strongly embedded in the West. They see it somewhere in the middle. It belongs to neither of these blocs. It kind of plays with all these blocs. Maybe that's the better policy option for the United States. If we're not getting the old Turkey back, but perhaps the idea is to cultivate Turkey as close to the U.S. as possible and keep it as far from Russia and Iran as possible. Whoever is elected and is in the White House by next year, that president, among their priorities, will be either dealing with Iran or with Russia or both. And there's no policy that this president will put into account that won't have a Turkey component to it. So I would say, as a nonpartisan take, I think Turkey remains important for the United States. But even more importantly, I think Turkey's democratic future is extremely hopeful. Just in finishing, Erdogan is loved by his constituencies, it's including people he has lifted out of poverty. But support for Erdogan among the broader population is at a ratio of nearly 1-1. But ironically, support for Erdogan under citizens, among citizens under the age of 35, meaning citizens born under Erdogan or who came of political age under him, remember that he came to power in 2003, support for Erdogan in that constituency among citizens under 35, are you ready? Is at a ratio of 1 for Erdogan, 2 against him. And guess what? There's about 1 million people in every age group in Turkey. Turkey's population is 84 million. So you got 35 million people who simply loathe him. And that's a demographics that's growing. And he knows this. So in the long term, it doesn't look very good for him in terms of democratic support. And I don't think he can maintain his popular support given these demographic trends. So I would say have faith in Turkey's democracy and also have faith in Turkey as a U.S. ally. And I think this is also the viewpoint that's going to be shared by most Turks who are going to look at their country's ability to shape events around their country. And they're going to conclude that Turkey still needs global allies and the United States is probably the best fit for that.
It is a perfect note to end on. I think you brought it to a beautiful close. I love that idea. I mean, it gets back to the point we talked about before of making U.S.-Turkey relations less about Erdogan, more about the relationship with the Turkish people. It has these traditions that to draw on and that people have to take the longer view and remain hopeful that those traditions reemerge and that there is a U.S.-Turkey relationship after Erdogan that looks a whole lot brighter.
And thank you. I guess I'm the perennial optimist. The glass is always half full, but I think in the case of Turkey, it is half full.
But and the parallels with Russia, though, are striking, I will say, too. I mean, just some of the themes, the lack of domestic support, attitudes among younger people, the importance of looking beyond these leaders and planting the seeds for a better future relationship and having optimism that it can be better is just so critical in so many of these difficult.
That's true. And even further, I mean, there are similarities, but I think. One of the reasons I love writing about Turkey is it's such a fascinating country. It kind of occasionally points at global trends. Erdogan is among the inventors of nativist populist politics. It looks like he's at the end of his steam. He's coming down. So it looks like, yes, there is an end to rise of nativist populist leaders. They ultimately come down. But also another lesson of Turkey is that for those of us who studied Iraq and Afghanistan, the conclusion was it takes a really long time to build democracy. But in the case of Turkey, the conclusion is it also takes a really long time to kill one. Yep. And I think, therefore, I'm really hopeful about Turkey's democratic future.
Soner, thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
Yeah, this was really a pleasure and I learned a ton. So thank you.
It was great. Thanks for hosting me.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been just great. And I do believe that core of friendship between the U.S. and Turkey, between the peoples is there. And I think that's another reason why the glass is half full.
I agree. Thanks, Jim. Thank you, guys. It was wonderful. Thanks for hosting me. I appreciate it.